Chapter 6. Holotropic Breathwork. A New Approach to Psychotherapy and Self-Exploration. Part 2. Supportive and Nourishing Physical Contact. In holotropic breathwork, we also use a different form of physical intervention, which is designed to support on a deep pre-verbal level. This is based on the observation that two fundamentally different forms of traumas exist, which require diametrically different approaches. This distinction is currently not recognized by mainstream psychotherapists. Borrowing the terminology from British law, the first of these traumas can be referred to as trauma by commission. This form of trauma results from external intrusions that damage the future development of the individual, such as physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, frightening situations, destructive criticism, humiliation, or ridicule. These traumas represent foreign elements in the unconscious that can be brought into consciousness, energetically discharged, and resolved. Although this distinction is not recognized by conventional psychotherapy, the second form of trauma, trauma by omission, is radically different in nature and requires a different approach. It actually involves the opposite problem, a lack of positive experiences that are essential for a healthy emotional development. An infant, as well as an older child, has strong primitive needs for instinctual satisfaction and security that pediatricians and child psychiatrists call anaclitic, from the Greek anaklinen, meaning to lean upon. These involve the need to be held and experience skin contact, be caressed, comforted, played with, and be the center of human attention. When these needs are not met, it has serious negative consequences for the future of the individual. Many people have a history of emotional deprivation, abandonment, and neglect in infancy and childhood that resulted in serious frustration of the anaclitic needs. Others were born premature and spent their first months of life in an incubator without intimate human contact. The only way to heal this type of trauma is to offer a corrective experience in the form of supportive physical contact in a holotropic state of consciousness. For this approach to be effective, the individual has to be deeply regressed to the infantile stage of development. Otherwise, the corrective measure does not reach the developmental level on which the trauma occurred. Depending on the circumstances and on previous agreement, this physical support can range from simple hand-holding or touching the forehead to full body contact. The use of nourishing physical contact is a very effective way of healing early emotional trauma, but using it requires following strict ethical rules. We have to explain the rationale of this technique to the breathers and sitters before the session and get their approval to use it. Under no circumstances can this approach be practiced without previous consent, and no pressure can be used to obtain this permission. For many people with a history of sexual abuse, physical contact is a very sensitive and charged issue. Very often, those who most need such healing touch have the strongest resistance to it. It can sometimes take time and several sessions before a person develops enough trust toward the facilitators and the group to be able to accept this approach and benefit from it. Supportive physical contact has to be used exclusively to satisfy the needs of the breathers and not those of the sitters or facilitators. By this, I do not only mean sexual needs or needs for intimacy, which of course are the most obvious issues. Equally problematic can be the sitter's strong need to be needed, loved, or appreciated, unfulfilled maternal needs, and other less extreme forms of emotional wants and desires. an incident from one of our workshops at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, can serve as a good example. At the beginning of our 5-day seminar, one of the participants, a postmenopausal woman, shared with the group how much she had always wanted to have children and how much she suffered because this had not happened. In the middle of the holotropic breathwork session, in which she was the sitter for a young man, she suddenly pulled the upper part of her partner's body into her lap and started to rock and comfort him. Her timing could not have been worse. As we found out later in the group sharing, he was at that time in the middle of a past life experience that featured him as a powerful Viking warrior on a military expedition. He described, with a great sense of humor, how he initially tried to experience her rocking as the movement of the boat on the ocean. However, when she added comforting baby talk, that made it impossible for him to continue and brought him back to ordinary reality. The maternal needs of the woman in the workshop were so strong that they took over and she was unable to objectively assess the situation and act appropriately. It is usually quite easy to recognize when a breather has regressed to early infancy. In a deep age regression, the wrinkles on the face tend to disappear, and the individual actually looks and behaves like an infant. This can involve various infantile postures and gestures, as well as copious salivation and thumb sucking. At other times, the appropriateness of offering physical contact is obvious from the context. For example, when the breather has just finished reliving biological birth and looks lost and forlorn. We have never had any problems with this method as long as it was used in a group setting. We had explained the rationale of this approach to the participants, and they all understood it. Everything was done in the open, and everybody saw what was happening. Bringing this therapeutic strategy into private practice and using it in a one-on-one situation behind closed doors requires special caution concerning boundaries. There have been cases when therapists using this method in the privacy of their office ran into serious ethical problems. The use of nourishing physical contact in holotropic states in order to heal traumas caused by abandonment, rejection, and emotional deprivation was developed by two London psychoanalysts, Pauline McCrerick and Joyce Martin. They used this method, which they called fusion therapy, with their LSD patients. During their sessions, their clients spent several hours in deep age regression, lying on a couch covered with a blanket, while Joyce or Pauline lay by their side, holding them in a close embrace like a good mother would do to comfort her child. Their revolutionary method effectively divided and polarized the community of LSD therapists. Some of the practitioners realized that this was a very powerful and logical way to heal traumas by omission. Emotional problems caused by emotional deprivation and lack of good mothering. Others were horrified by this radical anaclytic therapy. They warned that close physical contact between therapist and client in a non-ordinary state of consciousness would cause irreversible damage to the transference-countertransference relationship. At the second International Conference on the Use of LSD in Psychotherapy, held in May 1965 in Amityville, New York, Joyce and Pauline showed their fascinating film on the use of the fusion technique in psychedelic therapy. In a heated discussion that followed, most of the questions revolved around the transference-countertransference issues. Pauline provided a very interesting and convincing explanation on why this approach presented fewer problems in this regard than an orthodox Freudian approach. She pointed out that most patients who come to therapy experienced a lack of affection from their parents in their infancy and childhood. The cold attitude of the Freudian analyst tends to reactivate the resulting emotional wounds and triggers desperate attempts on the part of the patients to get the attention and satisfaction that has been denied to them. By contrast, according to Pauline, fusion therapy provided a corrective experience by satisfying the old anaclitic cravings. Having their emotional wounds healed, the patients recognized that the therapist was not an appropriate sexual object and were able to find suitable partners outside of the therapeutic relationship. Pauline explained that this paralleled the situation in the early development of object relationships. Individuals who receive adequate mothering in infancy and childhood are able to emotionally detach from their mothers and fathers and find mature relationships. By contrast, those who experienced emotional deprivation remain pathologically attached and go through life craving and seeking the satisfaction of primitive infantile needs. We occasionally used fusion therapy in the psychedelic research program at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, particularly in the work with terminal cancer patients. In the mid-1970s, when we developed holotropic breathwork, anaclitic support became an integral part of our workshops and training. Before closing this section on bodywork, I would like to address one question that often comes up in the context of holotropic workshops or lectures on experiential work. Why should reliving traumatic memories be therapeutic rather than represent a re-traumatization? The best answer can be found in the article Unexperienced Experience by Irish psychiatrist Ivor Brown. He suggested that in therapy, we are not facing an exact replay or repetition of the original traumatic situation, but rather the first full experience of the appropriate emotional and physical reactions to it. This means that the traumatic events are recorded in the person at the time when they happen, but are not fully consciously experienced, processed, and integrated. In addition, the person who is confronted with the previously repressed traumatic memory is no longer the helpless and vitally dependent child or infant that he or she was in the original situation, but a grown adult. The holotropic state induced in powerful experiential forms of psychotherapy thus allows the individual to be present and operate simultaneously in two different sets of space-time coordinates. Full age regression makes it possible to experience all the emotions and physical sensations of the original traumatic situation from the perspective of the child, but at the same time analyze and evaluate the memory in the therapeutic situation from a mature adult perspective. This understanding is supported by the reports of breathers who relive challenging traumatic memories. From the viewpoint of an outside observer, they appeared to be in a lot of pain and suffering immensely. However, after the session, they said that they actually had a positive subjective feeling about the process. They felt that they were purging pain from their bodies and experienced relief rather than suffering. Mandala drawing, the expressive power of art. Mandala is a Sanskrit word that means circle or completion. In the most general sense, this term can be used for any design showing complex geometrical symmetry, such as a spider web, arrangement of petals in a flower or blossom, seashell, e.g. a sand dollar, image in a kaleidoscope, stained glass window in a Gothic cathedral, or labyrinthine design. The mandala is a visual construct that can be easily grasped by the eye, since it corresponds to the structure of the organ of visual perception. The pupil of the eye itself has a simple mandala form. In ritual and spiritual practice, the term mandala refers to images which can be drawn, painted, modeled, or danced. In the tantric branches of Hinduism, Buddhism, Vajrayana, and Jainism, this word refers to elaborate cosmograms composed of elementary geometrical forms, points, lines, triangles, squares, and circles. Lotus blossoms and complex archetypal figures and scenes. They are used as important meditation aids which help practitioners to focus attention inside and lead them to specific states of consciousness. Although the use of mandalas in the tantric branches of Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism has been particularly refined and sophisticated, the art of mandala drawing as a part of spiritual practice can be found in many other cultures. Examples of particularly beautiful mandalas are the Nirikas, which are yarn paintings of the Huichol Indians from central Mexico that portray visions induced by the ritual ingestion of peyote. Elaborate sand paintings used by the Navajo people in healing and other rituals, and the bark paintings of the Australian Aborigines also include many intricate mandala patterns. The use of mandalas in the spiritual and religious practice of various cultures, as well as in alchemy, attracted the attention of C.G. Jung, who noticed that similar patterns appeared in the paintings of his patients at a certain stage of their psycho-spiritual development. According to him, the mandala is a psychological expression of the totality of the self. In his own words, "The severe pattern imposed by a circular image of this kind compensates the disorder and confusion of the psychic state, namely, through the construction of a central point to which everything is related." Our own use of mandala drawing was inspired by the work of art therapist Joan Kellogg, who is a member of our team at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center in Baltimore, Maryland, conducting psychedelic therapy. In her work as art therapist in psychiatric hospitals in Wyckoff and Paterson, New Jersey, Joan had given hundreds of patients a piece of paper with an outline of a circle and painting supplies, and asked them to paint whatever came into their mind. She was able to find significant correlations between the psychological problems and clinical diagnoses of these patients and specific aspects of their paintings, such as choice of colors, preference for sharp or round shapes, use of concentric circles, dividing the mandala into sections, and whether or not they respected the boundaries of the circle. At the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, Joan compared the mandalas that the experimental subjects were painting before and after their psychedelic sessions, looking for significant correlations between the basic features of the mandalas, the content of the psychedelic experiences, and the outcome of their therapy. We have found her method to be extremely useful in our work with holotropic breathwork. Joan herself saw the mandala drawing as a psychological test and described the criteria for interpretations of their various features in several papers. In our work, we do not interpret the mandalas, but use them in the sharing groups as a source of information about the breather's experiences. An interesting alternative to mandala drawing is the method of soul collage, developed by Sina B. Frost. Many participants in holotropic workshops, training, and therapy experience psychological blocks when they are confronted with the task of drawing or painting. This usually has roots in some traumatic experiences that they had as children, with their teachers and/or peers in art classes, or in their generally low self-esteem that makes them doubt their abilities and paralyzes their performance. Soul collage helps these people overcome their emotional blocks and resistances. It is a creative process which almost anyone can do, since it uses already existing paintings or photographs. Instead of drawing and painting supplies, participants receive a rich selection of illustrated magazines, catalogs, calendars, greeting cards, and postcards. They can also bring their personal photographs from a family album or pictures of people, animals, and landscapes they have themselves taken. Using scissors, they cut out pictures or fragments that seem appropriate to portray their experience. They fit them together and glue them on pre-cut mat board cards. If they participate in ongoing groups, they eventually end up with a deck of cards, which have deep personal meaning for them. They can take these cards to a friend's house, to sessions of individual therapy or support groups, or use them as decorations in their home. The course of holotropic sessions. The nature and course of holotropic sessions varies considerably from person to person, as well as from session to session. Some individuals remain entirely quiet and almost motionless. They may be having very profound experiences, but give the impression that nothing is happening or that they are sleeping. Others are activated and show rich motor activity to the point that they are agitated and frantic. They experience intense tremors and complex twisting movements, roll and flail around, assume fetal positions, behave like infants struggling in the birth canal, or look and act like newborns. Crawling, slithering, swimming, digging, or climbing movements are also quite common. Occasionally, the movements and gestures can be extremely refined, complex, quite specific, and differentiated. They can take the form of strange animal movements, emulating snakes, birds, or feline predators, and be associated with corresponding sounds. Sometimes breathers spontaneously assume various yogic postures and ritual gestures, asanas and mudras, with which they are not intellectually familiar. In rare instances, the automatic movements and/or sounds resemble ritual or theatrical performances from different cultures. Shamanic chanting, Javanese dances, Balinese monkey chants, Ketchak, Japanese kabuki, or talking in tongues, which is reminiscent of Pentecostal meetings. The emotional qualities observed in holotropic sessions cover a very wide range. On one side of the spectrum, participants can encounter feelings of extraordinary well-being, profound peace, tranquility, serenity, bliss, cosmic unity, or ecstatic rapture. On the other side are episodes of indescribable terror, all-consuming guilt, murderous aggression, or eternal doom. The intensity of these emotions can transcend anything that can be experienced or even imagined in the everyday state of consciousness. These extreme emotional states are usually associated with experiences that are perinatal or transpersonal in nature. In the middle of the experiential spectrum that is observed in holotropic breathwork sessions are less extreme emotional qualities that are closer to what we know from our daily existence. Episodes of anger, anxiety, sadness, hopelessness, and feelings of failure, inferiority, shame, guilt, or disgust. These are typically linked to biographical memories. Their sources are traumatic experiences from infancy, childhood, and later periods of life. Their positive counterparts are feelings of happiness, emotional fulfillment, joy, sexual satisfaction, and a general increase in zest and vitality. Sometimes faster breathing does not induce any physical tensions or difficult emotions, but leads directly to increasing relaxation, a sense of expansion and well-being, and visions of light. The breather can feel flooded with feelings of love and experiences of mystical connection to other people, nature, the entire cosmos, and God. These positive emotional states arise most often at the end of the holotropic sessions, after the challenging and turbulent parts of the experience have been worked through. Occasionally, positive or even ecstatic feelings extend over the course of the entire session. It is surprising how many people in our culture, because of either strong Protestant ethics or other reasons, have great difficulty accepting ecstatic experiences unless they follow suffering and hard work, if then. They often respond to them with a sense of guilt or with a feeling that they did not deserve them. It is also common, particularly in mental health professionals, to react to positive experiences with mistrust and suspicion that they are reaction formations, which hide and mask some particularly painful, unpalatable, and unacceptable material. When that is the case, it is very important to assure the breathers that positive experiences are extremely healing and encourage them to accept them without reservation as unexpected grace. Properly integrated holotropic breathwork sessions result in profound emotional release, physical relaxation, and a sense of well-being. Serial breathwork sessions present an extremely powerful and effective method of stress reduction and can bring remarkable emotional and psychosomatic healing. Another frequent result of this work is a connection with the numinous dimensions of one's own psyche and of existence in general. Some trained facilitators have used the deep relaxing effects of holotropic breathwork and offered it to various companies under the label of stress reduction. Others have utilized the bonding effect of holotropic breathwork workshops and described it as a method for team building. The healing potential of breath is strongly emphasized in Kundalini yoga, in which episodes of faster breathing are used in the course of meditative practice, pastrika, or occur spontaneously as part of the emotional and physical manifestations known as kriyas. This is consistent with my own experience that similar spontaneous episodes of faster breathing occurring in psychiatric patients, which are diagnosed as the hyperventilation syndrome, are attempts at self-healing. They should be encouraged and supported rather than routinely suppressed, which is the common medical practice. The duration of holotropic breathwork sessions vary from individual to individual and from session to session. It is essential for the best possible integration of the experience that the facilitators and sitters stay with the breather as long as he or she is in the process. In the terminal stage of the session, good body work can significantly facilitate emotional and physical resolution. Intimate contact with nature can also have a very calming and grounding effect and help the integration of the session. Particularly effective in this regard is exposure to water, such as soaking in a hot tub or swimming in a pool, a lake, or in the ocean. Mandala drawing and the sharing groups. When the session is completed, and the breather returns to the ordinary state of consciousness, the sitter accompanies him or her to the mandala room. This room is equipped with a variety of art supplies, such as pastels, magic markers, and watercolors, as well as large drawing pads. On the sheets of these pads are pencil drawings of circles about the size of dinner plates. The breathers are asked to sit down, meditate on their experience, and then find a way of expressing what happened during the session with the use of these tools. There are no specific guidelines for the mandala drawing. Some people simply produce color combinations. Others construct geometric mandalas or figurative drawings and paintings. The latter might represent a vision that occurred during the session, or a pictorial travelogue with various distinct sequences. On occasion, the breather decides to document a single session with several mandalas reflecting different aspects or stages of the session. In rare instances, the breather has no idea what he or she is going to draw and produces an automatic drawing. We have also seen instances when the mandala did not illustrate the immediately preceding session, but actually anticipated the session that followed. This is in congruence with C.G. Jung's idea that the products of the psyche cannot be fully explained from preceding historical events. In many instances, they have not just a retrospective, but also a prospective, teleological, or finalistic aspect. Some mandalas thus reflect a movement in the psyche that Jung called the individuation process and reveal its forthcoming stage. A possible alternative to mandala drawing is sculpting with clay. We introduced this method when we had blind participants in the group who could not draw a mandala. It was interesting to see that some of the other sighted participants preferred to use this medium when it was available, or opted for a combination of a mandala and a three-dimensional figure. Later during the day, breathers bring their mandalas to a sharing session where they talk about their experiences. The strategy of the facilitators who lead the group is to encourage maximum openness and honesty in sharing the experience. The willingness of participants to reveal the content of their sessions, including various intimate details, is conducive to the bonding and development of trust in the group. It encourages others to share with equal honesty, which deepens, intensifies, and accelerates the therapeutic process. In contrast to the practice of most psychotherapeutic schools, facilitators abstain from interpreting the experiences of the participants. The reason for this is the lack of agreement among the existing schools concerning the functioning of the psyche, its principal motivating forces, and the cause and meaning of the symptoms. Under these circumstances, any interpretations are questionable and arbitrary. Another reason for abstaining from interpretations is the fact that psychological contents are typically overdetermined and can be meaningfully related to several levels of the psyche. Giving a supposedly definitive explanation or interpretation also carries the danger of freezing the process and interfering with the therapeutic progress. A more productive alternative is to ask questions that help to elicit additional information from the perspective of the client, who, being the experiencer, is the ultimate expert as far as his or her experience is concerned. When we are patient and resist the temptation to share our own impressions, participants very often find their own explanations that best fit their experiences. On occasion, it can be very helpful to share our observations from the past concerning similar experiences, or point out connections with experiences of other members of the group. When the experiences contain archetypal material, it can be helpful to use C.G. Jung's method of amplification, pointing out parallels between a particular experience and similar mythological motifs from various cultures, or to consult a good dictionary of symbols. Follow-up and use of complementary techniques. On the days following intense sessions that involved a major emotional breakthrough or opening, a wide variety of complementary approaches can facilitate good integration. Among these are discussions about the session with an experienced facilitator, writing down the content of the experience, drawing additional mandalas, meditation and movement meditation, such as hatha yoga, tai chi, or qigong. Good body work with a practitioner who allows emotional expression, jogging, swimming, and other forms of physical exercise or expressive dancing can be very useful if the holotropic experience freed access to large amounts of previously pent-up physical energy. A session of Dora Kalf's Jungian sand play, Fritz Perl's Gestalt therapy, Jacob Moreno's psychodrama, or Francine Shapiro's eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR, can be of great help in refining insights into the holotropic experience and understanding its content. Many holotropic breathwork facilitators have found it interesting and useful to include Bert Hellinger's family constellation work in their workshops, which is his adaptation of a process that he learned in Africa when he served as Catholic priest and missionary with the Zulu people. Therapeutic potential of holotropic breathwork. Christina and I developed and practiced holotropic breathwork outside of a clinical setting in our month-long seminars and shorter workshops at the Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, in various breathwork workshops in many other parts of the world, and in our training program for facilitators. I have not had the opportunity to test the therapeutic efficacy of this method in the same rigorous way I was able to when I conducted psychedelic therapy. The psychedelic research at the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, MPRC, involved controlled clinical studies with psychological testing and a systematic professionally conducted follow-up. However, the therapeutic results of holotropic breathwork have often been so dramatic and meaningfully connected with specific experiences in the sessions that I have no doubt holotropic breathwork is a viable form of therapy and self-exploration. We have seen numerous instances over the years when participants in the workshops and the training were able to break out of depression that had lasted several years, overcome various phobias, free themselves from consuming irrational feelings, and radically improve their self-confidence and self-esteem. We have also witnessed the disappearance of severe psychosomatic pains on many occasions, including migraine headaches, and radical and lasting improvements for, or even complete clearing of, psychogenic asthma. On many occasions, participants in the training or workshops favorably compared their progress in several holotropic sessions to years of verbal therapy. When we talk about evaluating the efficacy of powerful forms of experiential psychotherapy, such as work with psychedelics or holotropic breathwork, it is important to emphasize certain fundamental differences between these approaches and verbal forms of therapy. Verbal psychotherapy often extends over a period of years, and major exciting breakthroughs are rare exceptions rather than commonplace events. When changes of symptoms occur in verbal psychotherapy, it happens on a broad timescale, and it is difficult to prove their causal connection with specific events in therapy or the therapeutic process in general. By comparison, in a psychedelic or holotropic breathwork session, powerful changes can occur in the course of a few hours, and they can be convincingly linked to specific experiences. The changes observed in holotropic breathwork are not limited to conditions traditionally considered emotional or psychosomatic. In many cases, breathwork sessions led to the dramatic improvement of physical conditions that in medical handbooks are described as organic diseases. Some of the dramatic improvements included the clearing of chronic infections, sinusitis, pharyngitis, bronchitis, and cystitis. After bioenergetic unblocking opened blood circulation in the corresponding areas. Another example is a woman with osteoporosis who found that her bones solidified during the course of holotropic training, which has remained unexplained to this day. We have also seen the restitution of full peripheral circulation in 15 people suffering from Raynaud's disease, a disorder that involves coldness of hands and feet, accompanied by dystrophic changes of the skin. In several instances, holotropic breathwork led to a striking improvement of arthritis. In all these cases, the critical factor conducive to healing seemed to be the release of excessive bioenergetic blockage in the afflicted parts of the body, followed by vasodilation. The most astonishing observation in this category was a dramatic remission of advanced symptoms of Takayasu arteritis, a disease of unknown etiology, which is characterized by the progressive occlusion of arteries in the upper part of the body. It is a condition that is usually considered progressive, incurable, and potentially lethal. In many cases, the therapeutic potential of holotropic breathwork was confirmed in clinical studies conducted by practitioners who we had trained and who independently used this method in their work. A significant number of clinical studies was also conducted by psychiatrists and psychologists in Russia, who have not participated in our training for facilitators. A list of studies involving or related to holotropic breathwork is included in a special section of the bibliography in our book on holotropic breathwork. On many occasions, we have also had the opportunity to receive informal feedback from people years after their emotional, psychosomatic, and physical symptoms had improved or disappeared, following holotropic sessions in our training or in our workshops. This has shown us that the improvements achieved in holotropic sessions are often lasting. I hope that the efficacy of this interesting and promising method of self-exploration and therapy will be confirmed in the future by well-designed, extensive clinical research. Biological mechanisms involved in holotropic breathwork. In view of the powerful effect holotropic breathwork has on consciousness, it is interesting to consider the physiological and biochemical mechanisms that might be involved. Many people believe that when we breathe faster, we simply bring more oxygen into the body and the brain. But the situation is actually much more complicated. It is true that faster breathing brings more air and thus oxygen into the lungs, but it also eliminates carbon dioxide, CO2, and causes vasoconstriction in certain parts of the body. Since CO2 is acidic, reducing its content in the blood increases the alkalinity of the blood, pH, and in an alkaline setting, relatively less oxygen is being transferred to the tissues. This in turn triggers a homeostatic mechanism that works in the opposite direction. The kidneys excrete urine that is more alkaline to compensate for this change. The brain is also one of the areas in the body that can respond to faster breathing by vasoconstriction, which reduces the amount of oxygen coming in. In addition, the degree of gas exchange does not depend only on the rate of breathing, but also on its depth, which determines the volume of the dead space in which the exchange between CO2 and oxygen does not occur. The situation is therefore quite complex, and it is not easy to assess the overall situation in an individual case without a battery of specific laboratory examinations. However, if we take into consideration all the above physiological mechanisms, the situation during holotropic breathwork very likely resembles that of being high in the mountains, where there's less oxygen and the CO2 level is decreased by compensatory faster breathing. The cerebral neocortex, being the youngest part of the brain from an evolutionary point of view, is generally more sensitive to a variety of influences, such as alcohol and anoxia, than the older parts of the brain. This situation would thus cause inhibition of the cortical functions and intensified activity in the archaic parts of the brain, making the unconscious processes more available. It is interesting that many individuals, as well as entire cultures that lived in extreme altitudes, were known for their advanced spirituality. We can think in this context of the yogis in the Himalayas, the Tibetan Buddhists in the Qingzhang High Plateau, and the ancient Incas and Quiros in the Peruvian Andes. It is tempting to attribute it to the fact that, in an atmosphere with a lower content of oxygen, they had easy access to transpersonal experiences. However, an extended stay in high elevations leads to physiological adaptations, including compensatory hyperproduction of red blood cells in the spleen. The acute situation during holotropic breathwork might therefore not be directly comparable to an extended stay in high mountains. In any case, there is a long way from the description of the physiological changes in the brain to the extremely rich array of phenomena induced by holotropic breathwork, such as authentic experiential identification with animals, archetypal visions, or past life memories. This situation is similar to the problem of the psychological effects of LSD. This is a substance with a known chemical structure that we can administer in exact dosages. However, this knowledge does not provide any clues for understanding the experiences that it triggers. The fact that both of these methods can induce transpersonal experiences, in which there is access to accurate new information about the universe through extrasensory channels, makes it difficult to accept that such experiences are stored in the brain. Aldous Huxley, after having had sessions with mescaline and LSD, came to the conclusion that our brain cannot possibly be the source of the rich and fantastic array of phenomena that he had experienced. He suggested that the brain more likely functions like a reducing valve that shields us from an infinitely larger cosmic input. Concepts such as memory without a material substrate, Sheldrake's morphogenetic fields, and Laszlo's psi field or Akashic holofield bring important support for Huxley's idea and make it increasingly plausible. In conclusion, I would like to compare psychotherapy using holotropic states of consciousness in general, and holotropic breathwork in particular, with talking therapies. Verbal methods of psychotherapy attempt to get to the roots of emotional and psychosomatic problems indirectly by helping the clients to remember relevant, forgotten, and repressed events from their life, or reconstruct them indirectly through the analysis of dreams, neurotic symptoms, or distortions of the therapeutic relationship, transference. Most verbal psychotherapies use a model of the psyche which is limited to postnatal biography and to the Freudian individual unconscious. They also employ techniques that cannot reach the perinatal and transpersonal domains of the psyche, and thus the deeper roots of the disorders they are trying to heal. The limitations of verbal therapies are particularly obvious in relation to memories of traumatic events that have a strong physical component, such as difficult birth, episodes of near drowning, choking caused by the inhalation of foreign objects, injuries or diseases. Traumas of this kind cannot be worked through and resolved by talking about them. They have to be relived, and the emotions and blocked physical energies attached to them fully expressed. Other advantages of holotropic breathwork are of an economic nature. They are related to the ratio between the number of participants in breathwork groups and the number of trained facilitators needed. In the 1960s, when I was in training analysis, it was estimated that a classical psychoanalyst was able to treat about 80 patients in his or her entire lifetime. In spite of all the changes psychotherapy has undergone since Freud's times, the ratio between the number of clients needing treatment and the number of professional therapists available for this task continues to be very unfavorable. A typical holotropic breathwork group requires one trained facilitator per 8 to 10 group participants. Although it might be objected that traditional group psychotherapy has a similar or even better therapist-client ratio, it is important to take into consideration that in breathwork groups, each participant has a personal experience focused specifically on his or her problems. Holotropic breathwork offers much more powerful therapeutic mechanisms, and it utilizes the healing potential of the other group members, who do not need to have special training to be good sitters. Sitters also repeatedly report what a profound experience it was for them to assist others. What a privilege it was to witness such a personal and intimate process of another human being, and how much they learned from it. A significant number of people who have attended holotropic breathwork workshops became very interested in the process and decided to enroll in the training for facilitators. The number of people from different countries who have completed our training and have become certified as facilitators has recently exceeded 2,000. Although not all of them actually offer workshops, this chain reaction effect of holotropic breathwork is a very hopeful sign for future controlled clinical studies. I would also like to mention an exciting trend. The theoretical knowledge and practical skills that participants acquire in holotropic breathwork training are useful for and applicable to the entire spectrum of holotropic states of consciousness. This includes those induced by psychedelic substances and various non-drug means, such as spiritual practices and shamanic methods, or occurring spontaneously, spiritual emergencies. In view of the current worldwide renaissance of interest in psychedelic research, and particularly the success of MDMA therapy with PTSD patients, and of psilocybin and LSD-assisted psychotherapy in the treatments of patients with life-threatening illnesses who suffer from deep anxiety, it is conceivable that in the near future, a significant number of sitters might be needed if some of these treatments go mainstream. The California Institute of Integral Studies, CIIS, anticipating this possibility, recently launched an accredited course for sitters in psychedelic sessions and has decided to use holotropic breathwork for training the candidates in this program until it becomes possible to legally offer them psychedelic training sessions. The Way of the Psychonaut, Volume 2.